Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Well, hello, Dad.
Well, hello there, Tater.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. It's a little hectic around here, you know, with the show going on and everything, but other than that, doing all right.
Yeah, our recording schedule's been a little all over the place. So to our listeners, thank you for hanging in there. We got, you know, the show must go on. All
yeah,
the shows.
That eats up a lot of time between rehearsing for the July show and doing the June show. Not that I'm in them. I'm just helping them directing and working backstage and stuff like that.
Now, that's not exactly true. You are in the current show.
Well, that's true. I am Thing, but, you know, it's just a hand. Nobody really knows who that is. Although I have been
very...
told. Yeah, there were two kids that have said Thing was their favorite character in the show. So
That dad can't, like, you just have the main character and you just takes over. Just even if it's just your hand on stage.
Yeah, a 7-year-old said, well, you're a lead. I mean, you're an Adams. I said, well, that's true, I guess.
There you go. I agree with that.
Thing Adams, I guess, is his name, full name. I don't know.
I thought your performance as Thing was quite riveting.
Well, I think next for me, I'm going to try to become a hand model.
Yeah, I think that's the only way to go. which is funny because I've seen your hands, Dad, and I mean,
they're not in good shape.
You've had a lot of injuries specifically to your hands.
Yeah,
like, you have a lot of fingers that don't bend all the way.
Yeah, and ones that are bent that don't straighten.
Your hand has a lot of character. I think that's why it's powerful on stage.
Maybe that's it. Or it could be that everybody is at least 30 or 40 feet away, so they can't really see that well.
No. It's like Humphrey Bogart wasn't necessarily attractive, but he was distinctive. You got one of those Humphrey Bogart hands.
Oh, all right. I've got a, like when you have a face for radio, huh?
You got a hand for television.
There you go.
It's June, which means Pride worldwide.
And we haven't done anything to do with Pride as an episode, so we got to get one in.
That's true. That was actually, I think, our first episode. I don't know if we released it first, but it was the first episode we recorded. Yeah, this podcast was actually born in Pride Month, so we're celebrating the third birthday of this podcast. Along with it?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't here when you started, but...
Well, that's true, but this is your first Pride episode.
We're on, what, 90-something?
Something.
So
a lot more than it feels like.
Yeah, well, probably just completing the second year, right? Getting ready to start the third year.
Yes. Yeah, so I guess it's two years, but we've had three Pride episodes, so this will be our third.
All right.
Well, in the past, for our Pride episodes, we've covered the events that took place at Stonewall, the history surrounding that. We've covered a couple prominent members, historical queer bartenders. We've talked a bit about the sort of elevation and expansion of queer culture as aided by speakeasies, which is pretty fascinating. But I thought that we could maybe talk just more broadly about the history of gay bars.
All right. That sounds good.
You know, I think it's the only type of bar that can be credited with aiding in the liberation of its patrons. I think having gathering places to exchange ideas and form movements for gender nonconforming individuals, queer individuals, like this was really important into leading up to all of the political activism in honor of gay rights. So, you know, they weren't just places to flirt and have a drink.
Yeah, well, it was also a place where a lot of people, I think, lived their lives being suppressed, and they were able to come in there and figure out, hey, I'm not the only one. There's others like me, and maybe that means I'm okay. Whereas society made them feel like they were an outcast.
Right. Well, that, I think that's, you know, I don't want to say the point, but that's, you know, the maybe the effect of society is to make you feel isolated in your identity. And then when you have this space that you can walk into and see people living out and open and proud, it's that's where you realize, oh, I'm not alone. This is real. Like, my identity is valid. So, yeah. So very important in the history of gay activism are gay bars. Now the whole scope of the history of gay bars, there's a, you know, every culture around the world has its own gay liberation movement, has its own bar culture. We can't really get into all of that in a 30 to 40 minute episode. So I just kind of want to give you a brief rundown of sort of where we start culturally developing the idea of these places, and then a little bit of focus obviously on America, because that's where we are. But to really find the basis for the need for gay bars, we have to go back quite a few centuries. Really back to around like when the moment where policing gay identities switched from the church to the government, which happened around 14th and 15th century Europe. That's where you all of a sudden had laws on the books against homosexuality. It's not just a, you know, something that God punishes you for. Now the government will punish you for. So because of that, when we have those early legislations, in response to that, a lot of our early awareness or proof of the existence of gay gathering places comes from police reports. One of the sort of the predecessor to the gay bar is often credited to be what was called a Molly House, and this is in the UK. It started around the 1700s. The term Molly House was used in the UK to refer to a meeting place for gay men. That term coming from the slang Molly, which was used to refer, it could be used to refer to like a woman born to the lower class, but also sometimes to refer to an effeminate man. And sometimes these places were written off as just brothels, but a lot of historians have argued that they weren't just brothels. They were places for gathering, for meeting, where people could dress in gender non-conforming ways. They would have marriages in secret at these places, gay marriages. And a lot, like, as society started to cement gender roles, I think it could almost be viewed as a natural place to develop alongside of that, a place to be free of those. Because we're talking about the era where we were really cementing the idea of this is what a man does, this is what a woman does. So I think it's only natural that you would have these places pop up and go, well, we need a place for that not to happen.
Yeah, and a lot of the laws in those in that time period was based on religious doctrine. Mm-hmm. So their laws followed what it was. It had nothing to do with freedom or anything like that. It had to do with religious laws.
Exactly. Well, and I mean, that's the basis for any legislation against, you know, gay individuals. They've found repackaging throughout time to say, no, it's about decency or whatever, but it always goes back to a religious origin. Now, these Molly houses, they weren't necessarily bars. They could have been bars. They could have also been coffee shops. Sometimes they were inns. Really just a place that was on the down low, known to be safe for gay, usually men, to gather. One of the most famous was Mother Clapp's Molly House. We know this because it was raided in 1726 after being kind of a quiet operation for 2 years. And subsequent decades in the UK saw occasional focus on and suppression of these places. Various records indicating the presence and tolerance of bars with a heavy gay clientele in major European cities throughout Europe, like, exist around this time. It's hard to say really where the first true gay bar was. Like, there's another, like, noted raid on a place called the White Swan in London in 1810 that, you know, was outed as a gay bar. But the first bar to openly cater to the gay community was possibly in France, which makes a lot of sense because France was one of the first places to be very accepting, very, like, non-punishing to queer individuals. And, I mean, homosexual relations were decriminalized since 1790, so that's
pretty progressive.
Yeah, decades if not centuries before some places.
Exactly.
And they had in general just a more relaxed acceptance of the community. But the bar Zanzibar, which is located in Cannes, was opened in 1885. and it was in business for over a century. It only closed in 2010. But really, throughout much of the 18th and 19th century, Paris was seen as the capital of queer acceptance in the world. Though by and large tolerated, so long as they kind of kept activity behind closed doors, there were decency laws that were put in place around the 60s and then eventually repealed in the 80s. But one of the safer places to be.
Well, somebody gets started pressuring someone there for some reason. They must have had a change in like their government or something that went along those lines.
Oh, in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, we'll kind of get a little bit more into it later, but the 50s and 60s were a strong conservative backlash, definitely in America, but worldwide as well.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Amsterdam was also an early place of acceptance for queers. It had many gay bars popping up throughout the early 1900s. One of the more well-known, still alive today, Café de Mange, opened by Bette van Buren, who herself was a lesbian. And I think her spot is kind of important to highlight because a lot of these early gay bars, gay spaces, were for cis gay men to comfortably gather. Her spot was open to sex workers, trans people, queer men and women alike. So, you know, this was a spot that kind of mirrors more, I think, where we want our queer spaces to be today, where it's just a place for people to be safe, all people that are sort of pushed to the edges of society to exist comfortably. And that bar was closed in 1982, but it reopened in 2008 and is still alive and well. Of course, Berlin was a hotspot for gay culture up until the rise of Nazism. And that saw the shuttering of most of its prominent gay bars in the 40s. But the scene stayed rather quiet until the decriminalization of homosexuality in 1969. So same year as Stonewall. Now, of course, thriving queer culture in Berlin, Germany as a whole. Now, to get stateside, laws against homosexual behavior were established along with the birth of the nation. We wrote the Constitution with them in there.
Right. They wrote it as being based on being a Christian nation.
Exactly. But even so, there are indications that there were places that were deemed safe for homosexuals to gather really as early as late 1700s, early 1800s. There's a bar called the Atlantic House in Provincetown, Massachusetts, that's sometimes considered the first gay bar in America. And it really came into prominence in the 1920s. Tennessee Williams was a big fan of it, but it was just sort of a, you know, down low place where people could gather and be openly gay and not get any problems for it. Now, as we talked about at that one of our first episodes, the 20s and the 30s in America saw a lot of cultural acceptance of queer identities. Like, drag performances were in vogue. You had the creme de la creme of, like, high society in New York City going to drag shows and speakeasies on the regular. But in reaction to this, we had this cultural backlash, as I mentioned, like the so-called... We had the Red Scare, and then we had the Lavender Scare. We were just afraid of colors in the 50s in general.
We were afraid of anything that we didn't decide was normal. If it was outside of this very, very narrow confines of what we said is normal, then we wanted that to go away.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad because, you know, if you looked at like the 20s and 30s, there was this cultural revolution happening in these speakeasy places where you had, you know, so many people sitting shoulder to shoulder drinking together, and then just this complete and total crushing of all of that once we get to the 50s. But in response to that, of course, you had queer individuals having to organize in effort to fight for their liberation come the 60s. One of the earliest groups to organize was founded by, actually, he just covered both colors, a communist leader and labor activist, Harry Hay, who was based in Los Angeles. So he was a prominent member of the Communist Party, but he's also an out gay man. And he decided to organize a group to focus on legislation that was used against homosexual Americans. And he founded the Madison Society. The name comes after medieval French secret societies of masked men who had used their anonymity to be able to criticize the ruling powers. Yeah.
That sounds like those guys in England that wore the Guy Ritchie masks or whatever they were.
the Guy Ritchie mask.
What was that?
Guy Fawkes?
Yeah, there you go. That guy. I had the wrong guy.
You're V for Vendetta, but it's a Guy Ritchie mask.
Yeah, that's it. Kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Guy Ritchie, just, Guy Fawkes, you know, what do you know?
Well, and the Mattachine Society, they were good because they would find ways to basically highlight and challenge rules on the books that were policing queer identities. One of these rules that they set their sights on, the New York City branch of the Mattachine Society, they really wanted to focus on this. So here's the sneaky thing about a lot of these gay rules or gay laws at the time, is they didn't out and out call out homosexuals. They equated them with other things. For instance, a bar could lose its license if it served disorderly people. That's true today. You can lose your liquor license if you regularly cause disruptions in your community.
Right.
But what that meant at the time was if you serve anybody that you can decide is a queer person, then you can lose your liquor license. So
because they're gay or queer, they're deemed to be disorderly.
Exactly. Just the presence of them. And I think this is done with an awareness of if we give them a place to gather, they might get ideas about revolution. Like, I think it's a pointed suppression of a movement. But there's a very important protest that is staged at one of the oldest gay bars in New York City. This is Julius, where this New York City branch of the Mattachine Society decided to confront this law head on. A little bit of Julius's history, which, Dad, I think you have some as well.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. Said that the space that Julius is located in dates back to the 1840s, and it started out being operated as a dry goods store, and that the bar itself is actually comprised of two buildings, and when you're inside, you can see a little dip in the ceiling in between, and it's because there used to be a courtyard there. That was a stagecoach stop on the old route, and the courtyard is where they would bring the wagon and the horses into to service them. And so that they got the they put those buildings together, and then during Prohibition, it was a popular speakeasy, and there are seven doors that functioned as entrances and exits. So when the city would come and shut one down during Prohibition raid, people would just use a different entrance or exit. So it had all those doors to operate. And it said up until about 14 years ago, they still used the original back door entrance that had a peephole in it that they could determine if you were friend or foe before they opened the door. Mm. And they said, but unfortunately, because of renovations that took place, they had to take that door down. But the current owner kept that door at their house just as a souvenir. And then the way it was constructed at that time is there were tunnels that ran underground between the buildings, and it was because of they used coal in their furnaces, and that was how they would run the coal in, is through these tunnels underground that connected them, all the buildings with each other. Well, later on in during Prohibition and even during the gay bar raids in 1960s, they would use those as a secret escape route to get out and go through. Now, those have since been closed off due to fire codes that changed. But at the time, like say during Prohibition and the raids, that was used for that. And then there's been a lot of debate over how it became known as Julius's. It wasn't that prior to Prohibition, but then after Prohibition, that's where it came out. And they've got the original liquor license that was issued on June 30th of 1934 for $200.
And, God. That hurts.
And it was issued as Julius's, and they said that
like $50,000 now or something like that. Go ahead.
Really? It was $200.
It's absurd.
But they said that one of the theories behind the name is that the bartender during Prohibition's name was Julius. So the people meeting on the street didn't want to say, "Are you going to the bar?" So they would say, "Hey, are you going to see Julius tonight?" So they say that's how it was. Now, the one that they're most fond of, though, was the owner was very fond of Basset Hounds, and his favorite Basset Hound was named Julius. And if you go to this bar, you'll find that at the foot of it, they have all these old, they're either iron or brass Basset Hounds that were made, and they line the foot of the bar. And so, you know, that lends some credence to that may be where the name came from. But they say those have disappeared through the years. I guess people stole them as souvenirs, and they have to have them remade to replace them at the foot of the bar. And when they do, they have to distress them so they don't look like new ones compared to the old ones. So they
look like an old dog.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't say, don't make them too good. Put some pits and scratches in there and stuff so that they look like the other ones.
You've got to teach a new dog old tricks?
Yeah, I think that's the way it works. But I just found all that fascinating, that some of the history of why that, you know, how that evolved into what it did, and how the various things were used. They now don't have seven entrances and exits anymore.
Well, I think that's fascinating, and especially because it has roots in Prohibition and operated as a speakeasy. I think it makes sense that it would have continued to be a, like, on the down low safe space to be a queer person. And this gets into a bit of the confusion about the event that I'm going to talk about. Before I get into that, you mentioned it was a raided bar, and I think it's good to understand what that means. So cops would raid bars that they thought were allowing disorderly behavior, aka gay behavior, to go on. And, you know, if you had two, I don't, people that looked gay, there's no other way to, because there were a lot of, like, the ways they would judge this is if, like, if you were just wearing the wrong clothes, if you were dressed too effeminately and you looked like a man, or you were dressed too masculine and you looked like a woman to them, like, that's how they would police you. And if you were having a conversation with somebody else at the bar that's encouraging homosexual behavior, that is something that we can raid your bar for. So We're not talking about, like, open, like, it was to the point that a lot of these bars would instruct, like, you can sit here, but you can't make eye contact with any other customers. You need to look straightforward. We'll serve you a drink, but any engagement with other people, because we can look at you and think that maybe you might be gay, we could lose our license if we let you talk to people. Like, so these raids were no joke. And I mean, a lot of bars at the time bought off the cops, because, you know, you also had heavy mafia engagement in a lot of these places, where basically, you know, the cops had to do these raids. So they'd do their raid at, like, noon when no one was there, when the bar was closed, and then check off the box. Okay, we raided that bar, and then take an envelope of cash from the mafia to let the bar keep operating.
Well, sometimes I think it was political reasons, too. I mean, people probably knew, you know, there were rumors and things like that, that this place might be a gay bar, this place might be a gay bar. So if you were, like, a guy running for prosecuting attorney, or just trying to get reelected, or mayor, or something like that, you're going to crack down on these places of that have no decency. And you do that. But, you know, most time you'd let them operate because it's just good for the economy.
Are you saying that politicians would create an environment of fear in order to get elected?
Absolutely.
Thus othering an underprivileged member of our society to get there? Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that does go on.
Yes, no, absolutely. And you're right. There were a lot of, like, focus would be kind of come in waves on the gay bars in New York City, and I'm across the country, and I'm sure worldwide, but definitely in New York City. It would come under focus when you had a politician that was trying to prove that he was tough on crime. So we need to manifest some crime. So here are some people that we've deemed might be gay because of the way they're dressed, and we can prosecute them and say that we did good work.
Right.
And so this law in the books, this law about not serving disorderly people, this is what the Madison Society decides to confront on April 21st, 1966. So a small group of members, they went to several bars around New York City, and they would sit at the bar, they would declare they were homosexual, and they would order a drink. And the first problem they ran into is that a lot of bars just quietly served them anyway. You know, there's a quote from, like, one of the bartenders that that served them. It was like, I couldn't tell they were homosexual. They weren't doing anything homosexual. They were just dudes at a bar. And I think it's worth noting, because it's always good to, like, have a modern perspective on the past. Like, the Madison Society was largely cis, white, like, affluent gay men. So these dudes coming into a bar, like a nice establishment in Manhattan in the 60s, ordering some drinks, it's not too hard to believe that they would have been served anyway. You know, they were not the most, like, put upon in their own community. But when they came to Julius, they were refused service. So they ordered drinks, they declared they were homosexual, and the bartender refused to serve them. It's sort of debatable, and I've seen people declare it both ways, that either Julius was actively trying to not serve homosexuals, or they were actually trying to help them, because by refusing to serve them, because of the law in the books, they could get that law in front of a court.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is possibly the more likely truth, because the bar already had a history as a speakeasy. It already had a history as a place that was friendly to gay people. So it was actually a very important thing. They refused them service, and then the Mattachine Society, these men that were refused service, could then take that to court.
Well, and also after the fact, it's continued to be known as a gay bar.
Exactly. So I think that's often mistold, that it's like told in the story like Julius was the bad guy in the story, and it's like, no, what they did was actually kind of important, because when they challenged this SLA, this, you know, liquor authority stance, it was defeated in court that basically queer people were allowed places to peaceably gather, and this could not be legislated. And that actually led to the opening of Stonewall. Stonewall had been around in different forms. Stonewall, like, reopened that same year after a bit of a makeover by the mafia owners in 66. So this court ruling actually directly impacted the ability for patrons to be open and out in more visibly gay spaces, such as Stonewall.
Yeah, because if you've got a law that's on the books that oppresses you, there's only two ways to get it changed. One is that your government passes a law to change it or change that law, but that means then politicians have to agree with you and side with you, and you weren't going to get that many of them in that day to side with you on changing that. So the only other way is to get a challenge that goes to court, and the court strike the law down as unconstitutional or illegal or whatever.
Right.
So that was a path that was open to them, and they had to get it by someone refusing them. So that does make sense that it was a planned thing.
They called this a sip-in. So, you know, we had sit-ins during the civil rights movement. This was a sip-in is what the Mattachine Society refers to these as. And I've heard them sort of talked about in both disparaging, like, this is, we're trying to show that we can follow your rules and sit in your places and like, fit in with straight society, basically. And the only difference is we happen to be gay. And I think that is one point to be made. And then the power of Stonewall comes from saying, no, we don't actually need to exist in your places. We deserve places of our own. Like, we don't need to fit in your society. We can actually create our own spaces, have our own identities. We don't need to be presentable and decent to your ideals. We can create our own. Just confronting laws and trying to get those laws changed couldn't do enough as much as making society change its mind. Being visible and out mattered.
Yeah. Well, like you say, it's a step. You know, get the law taken away first. Then from there, you can change, you know, work on society from there.
Yeah. Because that's the thing. Like, we're talking, you know, like presented, like the other law that didn't really exist but did exist at the time is this three article law, where if you weren't wearing three articles or more of the clothing of the gender that people assume you were, you could be arrested or harassed by police officers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So somebody judges as a woman from the outside, but is wearing like a three piece suit, could be bothered on the street for indecency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, same in reverse. And that these laws, they weren't real laws. They were actually sort of a perversion of an ancient law in the book about, like, masquerade laws, where if you disguise yourself to commit a crime, like, they were started by, like, farmers that would disguise themselves as indigenous people in order to evade taxes. So this is where these laws come from.
Yeah. And we covered it on Court Appointed before. There are still costume laws in certain states that are still on the books. I'm not saying they enforce them. They're just still on the books about you can't wear a costume, like, except for Halloween and some things like that. So, I mean, that's what those were used for.
Exactly. And that's it. And that, you know, whatever their intent was, they were perverted and used to suppress queer identities in the same time period. And that's, and the power of Stonewall is the people that, you know, threw those bricks. They were gender nonconforming. They were black and brown. They were sex workers. They were the people that, by the way they looked, they would have been harassed. And that mm-hmm. they were saying, no, we deserve space and we shouldn't have to conform. And that's, I think, the, you know, still like confronting the laws, but it was abiding by the laws of respectability can only get you so far. At some point, you just have to say, no, I just deserve a place to exist.
Well, you know, when you look at where we're at now, it's hard to believe that there was a time that it was like that.
The history matters because it's important to remember how recent it was. Like, we're talking, mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about the 60s, the 70s, but actually, it was like 2003 that a lot of the criminalization of homosexuality was repealed by the Supreme Court. Like, right. maybe they weren't laws that were enforced, but they were laws that were on the books in like a lot of states around America. And those laws haven't been changed. You know, the Supreme Court has ruled against them, but a lot of states have not changed those laws on the books. Like, mm-hmm. and we're not even talking about the world at large, where there are plenty of countries where homosexuality is still
outlawed.
Criminalized. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's illegal. Yeah. It's punishable by death. So yeah. the reason we celebrate Pride is to celebrate the strides we've made in queer liberation, but we're not there yet, you know.
As they say, look how recently it was that you have same-sex marriage legalized.
Yeah. So important to know that some people don't have to spend time in the closet, that they have parents that accept them from the beginning. But I think now more than ever, that's why our history matters, because it is important to remember what led us here, that there's this combination of ideas of, you know, challenging laws and changing laws, but also demanding space for ourselves, demanding that we don't have to fall in line with heteronormativity or you know, cis culture, that we can make spaces for ourselves. They're both important venues to liberation.
Exactly. It's the same as with racism. Have we come farther than, you know, the 50s and the 60s? Sure. Are we there? No. We no. still have more to go. There's still systemic racism that takes place, and there's still systemic you know, discrimination that takes place against gay and queer people.
Yeah. Well, and I think that goes back to the point you made about, you know, politicians that need to other somebody to get elected. Like, we still, as long as we live in an environment where fear gains power, then people are going to need to find somebody to fear. And our most underprivileged, oppressed members of society are going to keep getting that target on their head. So,
because they are them. And
exactly.
That's what you want to point out, is who the them are. To them over there, they're not us.
And that's a good thing to be aware of within yourself. Like, who are you theming and why? And is it valid? Mm-hmm. I see these conversations now in the queer community where, like, there's always this conversation about, like, leather at Pride or kink at Pride. Just, you know, more intense representations of sexuality at Pride. And, like, if it's okay or not. And it's like, I want to say, like, no. It's just, we accept them. That was our whole power. That's the people mm-hmm. that threw bricks at Stonewall, or cobblestones. It's debatable what that was. But they were sex workers. They were trans people. They were black and brown people. This is who fought for our liberation. And we were all the people that were forced out of society. And once we, like, well, society let me back in, sucks for you. Like, that's when we lose our power. There's a little bit of history about gay bars in across the world. Obviously, this is a Western view. You know, gender and sexuality are viewed very differently by different parts of the world. This is sort of a myopic view, which I'll admit to. It's our history, but it's not everybody's history. But I do think it's worth remembering just how important gathering places are. It doesn't have to be a bar. You know, I think it's great that there are a lot of queer spaces now are pointedly like alcohol free. I think that's a good evolution. Mm-hmm. But it started in bars, so it makes sense on this podcast.
That's right.
Gay bar is still alive and well. Now we're just, I guess, building them bigger. There is like this general concern of like, are we losing queer spaces? We are. There are less of them, but is it happening because there are more places where people just feel comfortable being out And I think that both are true. I think we still need places to gather, but I also think it's good that we have people being comfortably out at just regular bars.
Well, of course. And I mean, it's a safe space for people to go, you know, if you want to, but it's not like that's, you know, I may be naive, but I would think, I mean, there wouldn't be that distinction anymore. I mean, and it wouldn't be that you go and you hit on somebody same sex and then they're going to remove you from the bar or something like that, you know?
No, I think that it's more like a concern that people are going to be violent in response to that as opposed to just, no, thank you.
Well, you know, it's possible. There's going to be jerks in anywhere you go.
Yeah, it's true. But I think that no matter what, as long as there's still liberation work to be done, we need places that you can be authentically out and safe and you, and not have mm-hmm. to play that game of, is this going to end badly? Like, if you're at a designated queer space, you know that you can comfortably exist openly. And also for the whole, like, exchange of ideas. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. if you're picking up somebody. There are plenty of people in our community that are not interested in romantic or sexual partners, you know. Be you a member of the community or an ally, I think, you know, supporting a gay bar in your neighborhood is supporting a place for queer people to gather, exchange ideas, feel authentically themselves, and, you know, anyone can support that. You don't have to be a member of the community to tip your bartenders and buy some drinks.
And especially if they got the takeout cocktails and stuff like that. That's another way to help support them.
Oh, man, that just died in New York City. I'm so depressed.
Oh, really? I know we were talking about that last time. You were hoping they'd keep that.
It's unfair that they're not. I think that a lot of bars need it. I think a lot of revenue was generated. I mean, I know a lot of revenue was generated from that. I ran a program, but that was the only revenue. But they, now that we're not in a state of emergency anymore, they no longer have the emergency protocol, which was takeaway cocktails.
Hmm. Wow.
It's a bummer.
Because they have West Virginia that passed a law that you can, restaurants, bars can sell alcohol along with the food for carryout.
New York just decided to ruin the party.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Maybe things are better, but they're not back to 100%. And you've got a lot of restaurants and bars that are still struggling to come out from under the financial stress that did to them.
Oh, absolutely. Once again, I think it comes back to this decency fear. Like, oh, no, but people are getting drunk on the streets. I'm like, yo, they were before. They just were doing it in a paper bag instead of, like, supporting a place that needs money.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
Well, hey, happy Pride, happy Wrath, whatever you're engaging in this month.
Happy Pride.
Thank you, Dad. I'm really appreciative that you can have this conversation with me and we can talk about gay liberation and that you're my dad and you'll have it with me.
Well, sure. I'll be glad to. What does it matter what people do? You know, why can't people just, we're all people. And just be people. People who need people. People. They're the luckiest people in the world.
Is this a song? Are you going to lyrics now?
Yeah, it's an old one. It was way before your time. It was the 60s, though, so it's relevant.
Okay, well, there you go.
There you go. Tie it back in. It was probably 1966. That's when that song came out. People who need people are the luckiest people in the world.
Well, so thank you for joining us here on our commemorative Pride episode. If you'd like to support us, we have a Patreon. You get coasters and stickers and custom videos, which we will have one coming out again at the end of this month. If you want to find us on social media, we are NeatBoozeCast on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to email us, we are NeatTheBoozeCast@gmail.com. And
if you'd
like to
be part of the community, on Facebook, we are the group Neat the BoozeCast. See, it kind of sounds like all the other ones, huh?
Yeah, but Dad runs that, so, you know, if you want to show Dad what you made in your cocktail, he's there.
Yeah, and I pass them on to Tater, so, you know, in case it's a good one.
Yeah.
Which they usually are.
Yeah. Well, all right. Once again, happy Pride. I've been Taylor Strom.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been...
Meep.